So I had maybe one of the most endearing / embarrassing things happened to me not but mere moments ago.
Oh, okay.
Please share.
So our mutual friend, Elise.
Yes.
Who is the best ever.
Yes.
The best in the whole world.
Yes.
She's one of those people that, like, if she's around, you know that whatever it is, it's going to be handled.
Yes.
The combined forces of anyone plus Elise or just Elise alone can handle anything.
She really has the, like, I've got this handled attitude about everything.
And it's so wonderful and kind and very reassuring and sweet. And a friend was like, oh, Rowan, you have something in your teeth, which, you know, you want to know.
Yes.
And I was like, I can't deal with this. And there's no mirrors. I don't have anything to do it. And Elise went, I got this, and just reached toward me with her fingernail. And I, like, turned beet red and hid my face. She was like, give me your face. And she was like, well, I can't do it if you're wiggling. And I was just laughing so hard, trying to be like a good patient for her to get this thing out of my teeth, and also dying of mortification. And also, I felt so loved.
Yes. True friendship is the, like, we're going to skip the judgment part, go right to the established, I love you, I'm just going to fix this thing.
She was all in. It was taken care of, and she didn't bat an eyelash. And
That's
I've been on set energy too. She used to work in wardrobe on films, so that's like, I'm just gonna fix this.
Yes. Yeah. It reminds me, years ago at work, I had just started a job as a manager and was having a one-on-one with someone, and I could feel something in my teeth. Like, I had a bagel or something beforehand where I was like, I know for a fact that there is something in my teeth. And I had back-to-back one-on-one, so I didn't have time to, like, run out and go fix it. And in my panic, I messaged another one of our mutual friends, Casey, and was like, if anyone has something to fix this situation, it's Casey. She comes through. But of course, it's the caveat of, she's like, I have, like, a one of those flosser pick things. And she's like, here's the problem. I only have one, and I did just use one end, like, 5 minutes ago. Or like a minute ago or whatever it was. And I was like, do you think I have any shame? Do you think I won't use the other end of that thing immediately? Again, no question, no hesitation. She goes, got it. Walks down, walks outside the conference room that I'm in, which is a glass door. So I can see out. She can see in. The person I'm talking to is facing away from this. And she very casually, without missing a beat, puts a mug on the counter right outside the door and just keeps walking.
A queen.
Inside the mug was my salvation. She was amazing. It was incredible. So that same, it reminds me of that, of the energy of just like, we're not even going to question this. We're just going to solve it.
It's, there is something so weirdly, eerily similar about a person who's grown up in a huge family and there can't be germs because everyone's got everyone's germs, and someone that grew up in a small family and there aren't germs just because, like, no one's paying attention because that would, there's not enough humans to make that a concern. And I feel like you with your huge family and me with my small family, if you're in, you're in. Your germs are my germs.
Yes. Yeah, I think it's also attitude of who you grew up with. I don't know. I grew up with my mom is not like a let's go to the hospital about it person. Like, it's just not her attitude. But she's very pro-medicine. You and I have always talked about this. You and I are very much like, if I have a headache, I'm taking an Advil. Mad respect to the people who are like, I don't put medicine in my body. I just power through it. I so love that for you. If that works for you, it works for you. I really love modern medicine. Huge fan. Big fan. But I think it was right that my
Massive fan.
And I think for both of us growing up, like, you had to go to hospitals all the time with your family for legitimate medical concerns. But I think when things were like, oh, you got the sniffles? You can power through the sniffles, you know, which was the same for me. And I think that helps where neither of our families were like very scared of medical things.
My family also has that energy of like mud builds up your immune system.
Yes.
Like, oh, your hot dog fell in the fire while you were trying to cook it. That's just the seasoning of life.
It's just flavoring.
That's good for you.
It's just a nice char.
Okay. Legit though. I am such a monster. I really do like things to taste burned.
Me too. You gotta burn the marshmallow and then eat the outside and then burn whatever's left and then eat that.
Right. And also the fire is more fun than what I think most would consider to be an appropriately cooked or toasted food item. Hi, I'm Rowan Hall. I think we can all agree that fire is more fun, period.
Hi, I'm Tracy Harrison, and I love a toasted marshmallow. And also fire, I guess.
What else is going to toast it? Nobody answer that question.
No, if you're... Okay. I get if you can't go out and make a fire. Like, I don't have a backyard. I can't just, like, go out and make a fire in my backyard and roast marshmallows on it. I get it. We have options. We live...
We've talked about this. Anything can become a fire if you try hard enough.
And believe in yourself.
That is not a suggestion from Willing and Fable, the podcast that brings you original retellings and in-depth research on the history, mystery, mythology, and arson that makes the world so fascinating.
Each week, we research a topic from history or mythology or arson, and then we write an original story to go along with that topic. So if you'd like to support this show, drop us a line, toast a marshmallow, or reach out to us, because we're just silly little guys, and we respond very well to nice words.
We do. That's true. Say nice things about me. We do have that in at work where you can just go say nice things about me.
I love that. I wish I could do that at work.
Oh, you just drop me a line. I'll say nice things about you.
You can say nice things about me at any time, whenever you want.
Your bangs are laying just right today, which is no joke. Thank you. How rainy and humid it's been over there.
Oh my God. The weather's been so weird. We've had so many bouts of really heavy rain that I just look out and think it could be snow.
You can't have nice things. The world is warm now.
Yeah, the world is broken.
Back to us. If you want to communicate with us, you can find us at Willing and Fable on all of the social medias, including the ones that we all got but never use. You can also message us using our contact form at willingandfable.com. We have listener legends. We've got just a email us with your questions, comments, and compliments.
Oh, I like that. Questions, comments, and compliments.
Yeah, no concerns here. Or if you're one of our lovely, kind patrons, you can just chat with us on Discord.
Speaking of patrons, we have a few folks to thank for joining our Patreon. Natalie, Kyle K, Chris P,
James S, and Rico E. Like. We cannot thank you enough for helping us keep the microphones on. We really appreciate your support, especially in this day and age where you could support any number of lovely things,
right,
or just enjoy lots of things for free. We really appreciate you supporting our show. You're the best.
Yeah, it really makes us so happy and grateful that people care enough about what we do to want to support us. So thank you.
I did go on a rant today about how storytelling doesn't exist without an audience. And if you don't have someone who's listening to your storytelling, you're actually just talking to yourself in a room. So it is very, very nice that people listen to us and support us.
Yes, it is. Or one other way you can support our show is by reaching out to that person who's on your mind, but you're worried it's been too long since you've chatted, so you just haven't dropped them a line. But give them that call. Shoot them that text. I promise it will mean the world to your loved ones. But no matter what you do, we're just glad to have you here.
All right. So today's topic has been on our list for forever, I think.
Yeah, this was one you were excited to cover because you have a lot of thoughts on these creatures.
I do have a lot of thoughts. Today we're covering goblins. And before we go a single step further, I just want to say that we are absolutely aware of the anti-Semitic history tied up in the goblin mythos, and we're going to discuss it. Importantly, Tracy and I are both Gentiles, meaning we are not Jewish. It is not our place to define what is and is not anti-Semitic, nor are we going to presume to. But, like everything that makes its way to Twitter, the history and lore that surrounds goblins is pretty nuanced and very interesting. And despite what people love to tweet, they were not invented to mock Jewish people, but they've certainly become a tool that is utilized that way.
Yeah.
And we truly believe that it is best to learn all we can about history and nuance so that we are as informed as possible. And I hate to be corny, but especially in this case, knowledge is power.
Knowledge is power. Context is important. Nuance is everything.
The sword of context and the dagger of nuance. So we spend our time learning about history, mystery, and mythology, and we're going to approach this topic in the same way that we approach all of our topics, which is in the best and most accurate way we possibly can. On the topic of anti-Semitism, and in light of the current genocide that Israel is committing against Palestinians, I want to be abundantly clear that anti-Zionism is not the same thing as anti-Semitism. And anyone that tells you that it is using it as a false equivalency.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to take this opportunity to also talk a little bit about Palestine. This isn't something that we've done in a few episodes, talked about kind of the more recent happenings of the world in relation to our topics, but I think in this case, it's exceedingly important.
It's exceedingly important, and it's tied in. I think the last few topics we've chosen, it would feel very ham-fisted to squeeze it in there, as opposed to this topic, where it really makes a lot of sense for us to tackle all of these things.
Yeah, people can support Jewish folks and not be anti-Semitic and still not support Israel committing genocide. So the Free Press Journal published on December 31st, 2023, quote, U.S. President Joe Biden has bypassed the Congress for the second time in a row this month to release $147.5 million in aid for military equipment as emergency arms sales to Israel to fight Hamas. The U.S. is committed to the security of Israel, and it is vital to the U.S. national interest to ensure Israel is able to defend itself against the threats it faces. This proposed sale is consistent with those objectives, a U.S. State Department spokesperson said. End quote. Previous to that publication, on December 28th, 2023, in an article for The Intercept, reporter John Schwartz did the math and estimated that about 150 of each of our American tax dollars has gone to supporting the Israeli genocide of Palestinians. And previous to that publication, according to the New York Times, as of December 6th, 2023, quote, Dr. Zaire Salul, president of MedGlobal, stated, almost one out of every 150 Palestinian children in Gaza have been killed in just 2 months. We can provide more up-to-date information than what I've been giving us working backwards,
mm-hmm.
which is to say, according to Al Jazeera, as of January 24th, 2024, quote, more than 85% of Gaza's 2.3 million people have been displaced amid continued Israeli ground and air offensive that has killed more than 25,000 people, including 10,000 children. Catherine Russell, the executive director of UNICEF and former ambassador and lawyer who worked for President Biden and Barack Obama, has called Gaza the most dangerous place in the world to be a child. I wanted to start with how the U.S. presents its engagement with Israel and work backwards from there, because it is a very differently flavored conversation when people treat it like a war, especially a war on terror, which Americans in this day and age are uniquely primed to accept. And that conversation changes tune pretty quickly once we acknowledge the fact that innocent civilians with nowhere to go are bombed, and the majority of those people, well, not the majority, almost getting close to half of those people are children.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think it's a tricky thing to bring up the aspect of children, because I think it implies that if there were not children there, that Palestinian adults would somehow be less worthy of compassion. I think that's also a false equivalency, but I recognize that it is a slippery slope.
Mm-hmm.
I do think, bearing in mind that children who have as much interest in politics as you did when you were 12 years old are being killed is very heartbreaking.
I think also what makes this an interesting and different conversation that we've had in the past is we have the ability to see so much of what's going on the ground right now, directly from people putting it out and experiencing it. And it's not filtered consistently through a media narrative presence or a story that they want to tell. And so we're hearing one thing from one group and another thing from the group of people that are being infected. And so it's really impacting the way that people approach this situation.
Especially because Israel is an ethno-religious state.
Mm-hmm.
It provides a lot of opportunity to manipulate public perception. It also makes it really easy to say that people are not informed enough or that they are being biased or mm-hmm. anti-Semitic mm-hmm. in decrying the behavior of a government. So I think a lot of people tap out because they don't want to say the wrong thing.
Absolutely. Of course, you see a lot of people tapping out because they don't want to say the wrong thing because there's 1,000 different messages flying around. And then there are people, I'll be honest, I'm one of them. When we were talking about doing this, thought about my job. You know, it's there are real consequences to having these conversations. And that is in no way a reason not to keep having them.
Yeah. Yeah. There are a lot of complicated aspects to this, like the fact that an ethno-religious state was established in the Middle East with the support of the UK and the US because it's really, really nice to have a foothold in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of conversations about how the state of Israel using weapons against Palestinians for decades has allowed them to sell tested military equipment to governments saying, look at how good this works. Look at how well we utilize this. It's pretty bleak. But I think that there's also something to be said for the fact that there is no other persecuted group in the world that has an ethno-religious state established. And that being persecuted does not inherently invite you to steal land from other people. Mm-hmm. And that is complicated for Americans to talk about because we are living on land that was colonized. Yeah. And so saying, making anti-colonial statements feels like the next step there is, oh, wait, I have to turn it around on myself. And
yeah.
That is a part of the conversation, certainly, but I think that we should not delay the part where we say, hey, stop murdering children, just because we don't want to get to the second paragraph, which is, oh, wait, what about us?
Mm. Yeah, that's a really good point I hadn't considered.
Yeah, I didn't invent it. I'm trying to learn,
exactly.
And finding sources is complicated, but I do want to say Willing and Fable has donated to World Central Kitchen, a not-for-profit, non-governmental organization that gets food to, quote, communities impacted by natural disasters and during humanitarian crises. This is an organization that we donated to when Russia started attacking Ukraine.
Yep.
This is an organization that I turn to time and time again, specifically because they are a non-governmental organization.
Mm-hmm.
If you'd like to learn more about where we are sending money, their organization is linked at the top of our show notes. All right, now let's talk about goblins.
Let's do it.
Before I even go there, if you would like to have some context for things I think Tracy and I are going to bring up, you might want to go all the way back to episode 28, where we covered brownies and domovoy.
I can't believe that was 28. In some ways, that feels like that was way too long ago. And in other ways, it feels like, well, no, that was like 2 episodes ago. What are you talking about?
I think it feels like yesterday because I talk about brownies incessantly. and because tutelary spirits come up all the time.
Yeah, they in our lives, they really do. I just brought up brownies to someone 2 days ago.
Listen, it's cool, but they're part of the wider goblin species. And that episode, you know, could be a fun addition to this one before or after. So David Pickering's Dictionary of Folklore, which describes goblins, quote, generally grotesque in appearance, in European folklore, a mischievous breed of demon that delight in playing malicious tricks upon mortals. Variously depicted as inhabiting houses, mines, or trees, goblins are closely related to dwarves and gnomes, but are usually regarded as a more malevolent species, end quote. Keep in mind, that quote, we're really highlighting English, Scottish, Irish, you know, the Germanic, Celtic folklore, a little bit of the Northern Scandinavian kind of creeping in. And that's going to continue throughout a large portion of this episode because of the way that that specific amalgamation of mythology has been utilized in the modern era. But goblin itself is frequently used as a heading and not really as one specific creature all of the time. Think of it like fae in that way. Like, you know, you have the fairies. And the fairies could be the little guys with wings. We do use that word to specifically mean fairy, but it could also be Titania.
Right.
A full grown woman.
Yeah. Like the classic high fae fantasy character that you're all thinking of.
And a million creatures in between. The term goblin frequently encompasses gnomes, dwarves, brownies, imps, sprites, pukas, leprechauns, hobgoblins, kobolds, and more. My favorite creature that falls under this category, maybe brownies excluded, is a red cap.
Oh, red caps are fascinating.
Red caps are so punk rock.
They're grody little creatures. They're nasty little creatures.
I mean, okay, maybe.
I'm not saying that necessarily as a critique of them. They're just nasty little boys, B-O-I-S.
So they're murderous by nature and are said to sometimes inhabit the ruins of castles. They murder travelers with iron pikes and despite their iron-shod shoes will absolutely run someone down if they try to escape. Apparently, the Bible is the only thing that can stop them.
Of course
it is. You guys
know
what we're going to say about that. Mythology co-opted by Christianity. So the really punk rock detail that Tracy thinks is gross and I think is so cool is that they dye or wash their hats in the blood of their victims, sometimes allowing the blood to drip down their faces. And should their caps run dry, they just die.
Listen, I'm not saying it's gross, again, in a negative way. I'm saying it's grody and they're nasty and I love these little boys, but they're little freaky boys.
Something about red caps, I just respect the murder from them because they are all in.
Yeah. Yeah. They're fun creatures. You see them pop up a lot because they're great metaphors. They're great villains. They're great villains when you don't want any complexity around it. When you want a cool story, something that's scary to interact with, but it's not tortured by its own existence. It's just happy to kill.
There's no dark night of the soul here.
No.
Yeah, okay, that's gonna come up. Okay, remind me to circle back to red caps because it's gonna be a bummer.
Okay.
So why are goblins considered anti-Semitic? Thank you so much for asking, Tracy. According to HolocaustRemembrance.com, quote, anti-Semitism is a certain perception of Jews, which may be expressed as hatred towards Jews. Rhetorical and physical manifestations of anti-Semitism are directed toward Jewish or non-Jewish individuals and or their property, toward Jewish community, institutions, and religious facilities. So anti-Semitic canards or tropes include the idea of Jewish world domination, controlling the media, controlling the financial system, engaging with communism, guilt for the death of Jesus, desecration of the host, well poisoning, male menstruation, making people gay, lack of patriotism, lying about the Holocaust, secretly controlling the Atlantic slave trade, organ harvesting, and more.
I genuinely got distracted when you said guilt for the death of Jesus. Wasn't it Romans?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
The number of things in this list that is actually a specifically Christian majority behavior just rankles me.
Yeah. Oh, some of these I'd never heard of lack of patriotism, which also, I don't know, necessarily sees a problem.
It's, yeah, yeah. Okay, so in particular, the belief in blood libel stretches all the way back to 1144, when the body of a young William of Norwich was discovered in the woods in England. Blood libel, or the blood accusation, accuses Jews of killing non-Jews, especially Christian children, to use their blood in rituals.
We talked about this a little bit in our episode on the golems.
We did, yeah. So the interesting thing here is that Hebrew doctrine has a specific law about not consuming any blood at all. At all. And I'm sure you can see how the idea of blood libel would be attached to a creature from folklore and used to perpetuate terrible stories. Let's go right on back to those red caps. If we have creatures that like to utilize blood in their own creepy, messed up little ritual, it's easy to take that and make it anti-Semitic for the purposes of politics, just harming others. We've got options.
Oppression. I mean, oppression, yeah. Control, all of that.
And it works. So blood libel has led to numerous pogroms or violent attacks against Jewish people, often in the form of large, violent riots that are supported by local governments and authorities. There's also an appearance element to this. So because Jewish people were often described as subhuman throughout history, likening them to goblins, especially in political art and cartoons, has been and remains to be a very effective means of dehumanizing them and perpetuating stereotypes and beliefs associated with their appearance. Going all the way back to medieval Europe, a number of physical characteristics were assigned to Jews in the minds of Christians, including large hooked or crooked noses, clawed hands, sallow skin, hunched backs or posture, wild and specifically dark hair, as well as demonic traits like horns, tails, wings, and cloven hooves. So I think that there's a really useful, much more harmless example here, which is like when someone is called a speed demon. It's usually used for people who are driving too fast. And we liken them to being a demon because we have a language for what a demon is. Because of folklore and mythology, when you say the word demon, you're like, oh yeah, they're up to no good. They're doing bad things. They're not considering others. They're inherently evil. So when you say speed demon, it's not like saying speed god.
Right, right. You're in the messaging, you are framing it as, by the way, this is a negative thing.
So moving forward through goblin lore and how we understand it being used for anti-Semitic purposes, I think it's important to remember that goblins existed before their use as anti-Semitic propaganda because goblins were already an established folkloric language for tricksy, murderous, problematic little guy who is subhuman and not worthy of consideration and can be stopped by Christianity. So this is all coming up together in tandem, right? Goblins predate Christianity, and then Christianity, well, Judaism came first. But in terms of anti-Semitism, Christianity rolls around as like, I want that. And I also really want Jewish people to not have power. So I'm going to take that myth that people know and like and associate as evil, and I'm going to take these people that I don't like and associate them with the evil myth and say that the Bible can save you, and off we go.
Yeah, it makes sense when you lay it out like that.
There's an awesome folklorist named Ronald M. James that's written tons of books and papers on a variety of topics, but quite a few on goblins, and he's just rolled into Reddit threads, cited his own books and other scholars, and basically given multiple masterclasses on goblin lore.
Yo, Ronald, we love you. That's amazing.
I have such a fangirl reaction to this person. In one particular discussion, he wrote, quote, The idea of light and dark elves is problematic and rarely mentioned in literature, if at all, in folk tradition. It may be an early clerical attempt to dichotomize the supernatural into good and evil halves, a concept that was being imported with conversion to Christianity. It may not have been a part of indigenous folk belief, and it did not appear to catch on. That said, it became and has become enormously influential for fantasy literature, since the idea can be extremely useful in that context. So part of the goblin conversation, I think, is remembering that there are people who are indigenous to all parts of the world to some extent. Could we chase it back and say everybody goes to Africa? Yes, right. We could. We're not going to do that. But it is important to remember when we think of kind of the overarching idea of whiteness and its relationship with Christianity and how people are invited or not invited into whiteness as it suits power at any given moment. For example, at certain times, Italian people were not considered white. Irish people were not considered white. And then, of course, the more obvious ones of like Black people, Native American people, Jewish people are not considered white. But when we look at indigenous religions, frequently, but not always, there is not as much of a concept of things being all good and all evil. If you look at the ancient Greek pantheon, for example, we have Zeus.
Right.
He does some good things and he does some crummy things.
They all do good and bad. They're just fickle, powerful beings.
So if you take brownies, for example, which are categorized in the goblin family, if you are nice to them, they will do good things for your home. They will take care of your house. But also, they will absolutely wreck your crops if you make a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
There is a fear there. Also, unfortunately, we're not going to dive into the negative association between brownies and Black people in slavery, but it's right there. I'm sure we can all imagine.
Yeah.
It's bleak in goblin territory. So folks who have done a lot more studying than I could ever accomplish in this lifetime have called out anti-Semitic goblins in the works of the Brothers Grimm, Shakespeare's plays, medieval art, and of course, so many political cartoons. One, it's worth searching these things so you know kind of what we're contending with when we imagine anti-Semitic goblins, but specifically as Nazis rose to power in Germany, there were anti-Semitic cartoons made to portray, you know, Jewish people controlling all the money and making it their fault that you're poor and drawing those people to look like goblins that control the banks. We see some examples that are often blown out of proportion on the internet, but situations where, for example, plague was rampant in an area and the Jewish community actually survive pretty well. And that's because Jewish doctrine has a lot of details about how you should maintain yourself and your home and your food to stay clean.
Mm-hmm.
And in a time before germs, they managed to take care of germs really well, while the Christian community, which was slowly working its way and deep in the idea that bathing was bad, was dying.
Right.
And kind of going back to banks, one of the most famous political cartoons and terms is actually the Gnomes of Zurich.
Oh.
It specifically disparages Swiss bankers. In November 1964, there was a famous meeting where British politician George Brown criticized the Swiss bankers, saying, quote, "The Gnomes of Zurich are at work again," because the British were blaming the Swiss bankers for raising speculation against the British pound at a time that England's economic growth was incredibly low compared to Germany and France.
Mm.
I do not know if there was the belief associated with this anger that the Swiss bankers were also Jewish, or if the bankers in this scenario were made to seem like goblins, gnomes in this case, mm-hmm. because the association already existed. So we're already starting to see this tangled web.
Mm-hmm.
So with a bit of reverence in my voice, I'm going to quote a really, really large portion of Ronald M. James' writing that he kindly posted on what was basically the best Reddit thread I have ever read. I had a work cited. It was so cool.
Oh my God, that's amazing.
I originally did try to rephrase what he wrote, and then it felt like such a poor, watered-down imitation.
I have done that so many times. You're like, okay, I'm going to reword this. And then you're like, I can't say it better. I don't know it well enough. I'm just going to take the quote because, you know what? They said it best.
So this is from his book, The Folklore of Cornwall, The Oral Tradition of a Celtic Nation. Quote, anthropologist Paul Manning put forward a provocative treatment of knocker folklore, focusing on the asserted Jewish origin of the entities. He maintains that the Jews became by turns ghosts, fairies, and then nothing at all. The intent here is not to diminish Manning's work, which contributes an enormous amount with his consideration of this Jewish motif. Nevertheless, examining the knockers in the context of other Northern and Western European beliefs places the idea of a Jewish origin in a different context. The Cornish believed that the eerie environment of the mine was populated with a specialized type of supernatural being of nature. They then considered the origin of these creatures. They almost certainly did not begin with a belief in an ancient Jewish population associated with mining that somehow devolved into supernatural beings. Manning is correct to ask why Cornish knockers became so closely linked with Jews, and he is free to construct ways to place this association in perspective in the context of the development of capitalism. The Jewish associations of the knockers is yet another unique Cornish fingerprint in the realm of European folklore, but it is an after-the-fact conjecture on the part of the folk. The knockers began as supernatural beings of nature, and the folks, as they did throughout Europe, blended them with ghosts and other traditions as they tried to make sense of what they regarded as the extraordinary in their midst. The Jewish folk explanation for knockers should not mask the fact that these entities act like and are assumed to be a kind of fairy attached to a specific occupation. The knockers can be understood as underground supernatural beings who attracted an array of legends and beliefs associated with the mistaken idea that there were once ancient Jewish miners in Cornwall. Like many other European fairies, the knockers show a muddling of the distinction between ghosts, particularly of the long dead, and elves. End quote. So I started there in my research
mm-hmm.
and was like, excuse me, what? So let's kind of double back.
Okay.
Knockers or Tommy knockers are a type of goblin.
Mm-hmm.
They live underground and they live in mines.
And I'm guessing they knock.
Presumably. And knockers in Cornish folklore would lead those miners who behaved well and were not too greedy to areas of more minerals to mine or protect them from danger, and were for the most part considered to be tricksy but benevolent,
mm-hmm.
which is what we see in a lot of mythology. And turns out that in this area where this folklore existed, for a very long time, it was specific that these goblins that lived underground were the dead spirits of Jewish miners.
Yeah, that is what's really fascinating.
So we're back to the Christianity mm-hmm. ruining the party again.
Okay.
And from what I understand, it comes from this need to have Jewish folks who participated in the crucifixion of Jesus Christ
mm-hmm.
and who lived in the area and worked in mines and were bad and died. But despite the fact that there's absolutely no reason to think that there was a specific population of miners that were also Jewish.
Yeah, those famous ancient Cornwall Jewish miners, it's weird that we don't talk about them more, you know?
I think it comes from a need to be prosecuted. Like, if there were Jewish people here and they hated Christians, then you can continue to use the lore of their existence from once upon a time forever and ever. Amen.
I think it's also something where it's just enough other to be interesting without being scary or unimaginable or unfathomable.
So I'm sitting here asking, of course, you know, what the heck? And Ronald had my back.
Of course he did. You go, Ronald.
He said, and I quote, "It's an odd thing, and I doubt there were a lot of Jews in the distant British peninsula. Cornwall was big on passion plays, however, so my guess is that they placed Jews in the mines more by the reputation of what Jews were all about rather than by actual experience. The odd thing, of course, is that the miners generally looked on the knockers in very favorable terms, although they were to be treated with extreme caution and respect. So much for exiles in perpetual punishment." And that's going to the idea that the Jewish people should be exiled and punished forever. We're underground, right? We're getting closer to hell. Like, right. This is just the twining of mythos. But the people in this area still did not make these Jewish goblins inherently bad, which is so interesting because this is one of the few specifically Jewish goblins that exist in folklore. And not come from pop propaganda and get reverse engineered into folklore because people consider modern fantasy fiction to be folklore now.
That is so interesting. I hadn't pieced together that they are very specifically Jewish goblins. And yet they're treated kind of like brownies of like, yeah, you give them respect, you give them space, but, you know, don't mess with them. They won't mess with you.
There's a lot of don't mess with the fae. Mm-hmm. And goblins are just fae in this pantheon.
Absolutely.
I should say this and the surrounding pantheons. So this is the one that really excites me. Okay, so we're back to knockers. This is from My Guy Ronald's publication, Knockers, Knackers, and Ghosts, Immigrant Folklore in the Western Mines.
I love it.
He says, "The idea of exiled Roman Jews was historically impossible in the New World, and Americans have seldom welcomed the belief in elves. As a result, the Cornish immigrants did not talk of Jewish spirits. The belief in ghosts, however, persisted in America, and so the notion of knockers as the shades of dead miners became popular in the minds of the West."
Mm-hmm.
"The principal difference between the European and American expression of this folklore lies in what the Tommyknockers did to or for the miners. In Cornwall, most legends tell of knockers rewarding good and punishing evil. The underlying moral of the Cornish tradition is that a miner who is willing to accept a moderate income and who is not too ambitious or inquisitive is worthy of reward. American culture, however, reinforces ambition, creativity, and curiosity. The Cornish type of legend, telling of miners rewarded for following sounds without question and then taking only a portion of the wealth, did not survive in America. American folklore cannot condemn a miner's desire to take everything."
That's really interesting.
Capitalism strikes again. So we're getting this migration of mythology. It comes to a new land where you're like, okay, we can't just put Jewish people here and call it OG.
Yeah.
It's not going to work.
Yeah, it's not flying with them.
So we're going to bring ghosts, and this mythology is going to continue to survive. But now that it's all the people that have moved across the sea to try to make their lives better, and we're building this culture of curiosity and wealth, now they have to be ghosts, and now they have to reward us for going for the money. And we're seeing capitalism come into the inherently Christian version of this mythology that will then be recycled back into anti-Semitism. It's really exciting because it's interesting, but it's really terrible.
It's complicated. I mean, it's just really – it's – what a good job you're doing of untangling this complicated knot of mythology.
Thanks. So we can't talk about high fantasy bigotry without mentioning Tolkien.
Yeah.
And this is exactly what I said earlier, which is there is this understanding on, I think, the internet in particular, that the major pillars of fantasy fiction are somehow also folklore. And I think there is a case to be made that there is a modern folklore built within the fiction community and within the online community. Mm-hmm. But to say that fiction is the end-all, be-all definition of what folklore always has been happens a lot and is not true. I think that very often, and we're going to see, we can see the results of people's beliefs mm-hmm. and how it, it makes its way into fiction and how it is then perpetuated. But I just want to make sure that while we're talking about this, people know that just because Tolkien was a bigot, and we're going to find that out, doesn't mean that he just whole cloth copy-pasted
right.
the original folklore.
Yeah.
So goblins do exist in Tolkien's Middle Earth, but they're really just a type of orc. And we could do another episode on how orcs are used as terrible depictions of black people.
Mm-hmm.
But that would require another episode.
Right. Yeah. There's only so much we can fit into single episodes.
In Tolkien's writing, the dwarves are actually our analog for Jewish people. Unfortunately, we cannot let him off the hook on good faith just because it's dwarves and not goblins, because we already know dwarves sometimes fall under the goblin heading.
Mm-hmm.
And Tolkien actually wrote, and I quote, quote, "Dwarves were like Jews, at once native and alien in their habitations." In another interview, he said, quote, "The dwarves, of course, are quite obviously, couldn't you say that in many ways they remind you of the Jews?" End quote.
This is one of those topics that's really tough and frustrates me, because it's so frustrating when you have a great type of character, a great story, great elements, and it is tied into something that is troubling or problematic or hurtful. The idea that, you know, you could have these creatures that are dwarves, if you separate it from our world and where it came from, there's a reason that people still use dwarves in so many settings. They're great characters. There's a reason to see goblins in so many settings. They're great characters. And it's so hard to then dive into it and break down the nuance. And, you know, having the idea of characters like orcs, where they could be these big, strong characters, or there's a lot of things you can assign to orcs on their own, is fascinating to explore, but then you get it tied into our world. I'm not getting to any singular point here other than it's really hard with the intersection of mythology and real life and storytelling.
Yeah, it's really frustrating, especially because the logic of dwarves, it makes sense that dwarves would be interested in the value of different minerals if they mm-hmm. are miners by nature. And then all of a sudden, as soon as you say, "and that is inherently Jewish,"
mm-hmm.
you're like, oh, there it is.
Yep.
There's the anti-Semitism. Now you can never, ever get away with just saying you made a character. And we often bring prejudice with us that we don't realize that we have. So even worse, Tolkien did base a lot of the dwarf culture on Norse Viking-inspired elements,
mm-hmm.
and that's cool. But they were also created separately from the, quote, good races in Middle Earth, and they are obsessed with valuable minerals, and he did say the quiet part out loud.
Yeah. Yeah, he did.
So Matthew Wills, writing for the JSTOR Daily article, J.R.R. Tolkien's Jewish Dwarves, continues a discussion that scholar Rebecca Brackman began in her paper, Similarity Between Dwarves and Jews, or more accurately, Cultural Assumptions About Jewishness. Will says, quote, "But then came the Lord of the Rings. Gimli the dwarf was not like his predecessors. On dwarves, The Hobbit shows that they were, quote, not heroes, but calculating folk with a great idea of the value of money. Gimli broke this mold. He was a hero. He valued nature for its beauty, not its worth in precious minerals. He represented," writes Brackman, "a radical shift in the characterization of dwarves. And Gimli was portrayed as a representative figure, not an outlier. With Gimli," continues Brackman, "it's as if Tolkien set out to undo the negative qualities ascribed to the dwarves in the earlier book and shows them as no longer marginal to the heroic culture of the other characters," end quote.
And I think that is what makes Gimli so fascinating, is that he is not an outlier. And that really, I would agree, changed the course of how dwarves are represented in media.
Yeah, I mean, this is that moment of like, did you learn a thing? And then you went down that path? Because it's a bummer you died keep going, buddy.
Yeah. I just like the sentiment. It's a bummer you died.
It's a bummer you died. I found this really, really interesting story in the Chester Review in the article, "Do Anti-Semitism Charges Against Tolkien Ring True?" Craig Bird tells a story, quote, "After Hitler came to power, prior to World War II, the German government officially requested through Tolkien's publisher that he establish his racial purity so they could authorize a translation of The Hobbit. The Oxford Don, struggling financially to support his family, could have used the income from Third Reich sales. Instead, though Tolkien obviously is a Germanic name, he took the opportunity to remind the Nazis of the ludicrous pretension of racial purity. Quote, thank you for your letter. I regret that I am not clear as to what you intend, he wrote. I am not of Aryan extraction, that is Indo-Iranian, as far as I am aware. None of my ancestors spoke Hindustani, Persona, Gypsy, or any related dialects. But if I am to understand that you are inquiring whether I am of Jewish origin, I can only reply that I regret I appear to have no ancestors of that gifted people." End quote. I think this story is a perfect example of the way that people can do good things and do bad things.
Mm-hmm.
Because he wrote about mythical creatures and he was just a man.
And it's also worth noting the time in which he lived, the things that he was exposed to day in and day out, which aren't excuses, but do contextualize the experiences or the way that he communicates things.
Which is so cool, except he lived for forever. Didn't he die in the 60s or 70s?
I don't remember the specifics of his life. I know my friends and I looked it up at one point because we were all debating whether or not Lord of the Rings was an allegory for the Industrial Revolution.
He died in 1973.
Yeah, that tracks. He also, people couldn't go on walks with him because he would just get distracted and talk about trees for 2 hours.
People contain multitudes, and some of those multitudes, unfortunately, are anti-Semitic.
Yes. Well, speaking of.
Speaking of, okay, I'm going to power through this so fast because the way I don't want to talk about J.K. Rowling is just
It's deep insane. And profound. Yeah.
And so we all know that she's devoted a lot of time and energy and money to hating trans people, and she sucks. So this is just a continued part of her sucking.
Yep.
In December 2021, on Jon Stewart's podcast, The Problem with Jon Stewart, he says, quote, here's how you know Jews are still where they are. Talking to people, here's what I say. Have you ever seen a Harry Potter movie? Have you ever seen the scenes in Gringotts Bank? Do you know what those folks who run the bank are? Jews. And they're like, oh, that illustration is from Harry Potter. And you're like, no, that's a caricature of a Jew from an anti-Semitic piece of literature. J.K. Rowling was like, can we get these guys to run our bank? It's a wizarding world. We can ride dragons. You can have a pet owl. But who should run the bank? Jews. But what if the teeth were sharper? It was one of those things where I saw it on the screen and I was expecting the crowd to be like, holy shit, Rowling did not, in a wizarding world, just throw Jews in there to run the fucking underground bank. He added, and everybody was like, wizards. It was so weird. End quote. So he's referencing anti-Semitic illustrations from the book The Protocols of the Elders of Zion that was published in 1903. And he's right.
Mm-hmm. He's completely right.
The problem that I see happening in J.K. Rowling is that, and this is a guess, I will say. Like, I do not know this person, luckily. I don't think she sits around twiddling her thumbs and thinking about how to be anti-Semitic vocally in public. Because, you know, she did that event at the Holocaust Museum. And the actor who plays Harry Potter, Daniel Radcliffe, his mom is Jewish. He's culturally Jewish. Like, there's there's some things going on there. I think she just took anti-Semitic goblins and ran with it and doesn't ever have to think about it.
Yes.
Because she's a now affluent white woman in England who has never had to think about the way depicting slavery or Jewish-seeming goblins would affect people.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I think what probably started out as naivety, you know, maybe then turned into intentional ignorance or active harm. But there is something to be said of people who just go along with what they believe and have been told, and then are told they're wrong and get very defensive about it.
Right. And again, being ignorant of a thing doesn't mean that you are held blameless and it's okay that you did the thing. It's just, I think, an interesting part to remember that people can be cruel by accident and then can continue to dig in their heels when they learn better. I think when I think of J.K. Rowling in relation to her goblins, I tend to think of Hanlon's razor, which is never a tribute to malice, that which is adequately explained by stupidity.
I reference that probably once a week.
So we've talked about the adaptation of the goblin mythos over time, mm-hmm. which is to say it became increasingly anti-Semitic. And to my mind, it's suffering a fate not entirely unlike the swastika, which was used to terrible ends and continues to be used to terrible ends by Nazis. But the swastika was an appropriation of a symbol that was previously had nothing to do mm-hmm. with terror and harming people, and then was used to specifically harm Jewish people. In their article for the BBC, How the World Loved the Swastika Until Hitler Stole It, Mukti Jane Campion writes, "In the ancient Indian language of Sanskrit, swastika means well-being. The symbol has been used by Hindus, Buddhists, and Jains for millennia and is commonly assumed to be an Indian sign. The irony is that the swastika is more European in origin than most people realize. Archaeological finds have long demonstrated that the swastika is a very old symbol, but ancient examples are by no means limited to India. It was used by the ancient Greeks, Celts, and Anglo-Saxons, and some of the oldest examples have been found in Eastern Europe, from the Baltic to the Balkans." End quote. I didn't know that the Nazi symbol of the swastika had a specific name. Campion continues, quote, "The black straight-armed Hakenkreuz, or hooked cross, on the distinctive white circle and red background of the Nazi flag would become the most hated symbol of the 20th century, inextricably linked to the atrocities committed under the Third Reich." There is a lot of discussion over time about whether the swastika can be reclaimed, mm-hmm. as it can look a number of different ways that were never utilized by anti-Semites, and people still include it in religious and cultural practices that date back thousands of years. I am not advocating for the reclamation of the swastika, period. If there is ever a point in the distant future that folks want that to be a thing, that is certainly not for me to decide. What is for me to decide is how I can remember context when I examine history.
Mm-hmm.
So when people look at ancient art, they see swastikas.
Right, yeah.
And have to contextualize their appearance. Was this Paleolithic person anti-Semitic when they carved that shape of a swastika into a bird that was made out of mammoth tusk? And that's a real example that I found. And the answer is no, because Judaism's origins lie in the Bronze Age. So that form of bigotry wasn't invented yet.
If you want that form of bigotry, you got to wait a little bit.
Thousands of years. So when historians looked at that symbol in that carving, they had to contextualize it in the person's world to understand them. Notably, the actual pattern of that mammoth ivory somewhat resembled the shape of a swastika. So historians have been wondering if the person carved it that way because they saw that pattern naturally in the keratin bone fibers that make ivory. I was like, oh, yeah, I'm cool. Nature, I'm carving. I'm from the pre-Bronze Age.
Right. Isn't there a thing in design nowadays where you have to look at your whatever you've designed and determine if there's a swastika or a penis in it?
Yeah, 100%. And I spend so much of my time Googling to make sure that neo-Nazis haven't decided to take a symbol or an idea or a god or a thing and make it anti-Semitic.
Yeah.
Knowing the history about the swastika, for example, in this case, looking at the ivory and chasing it through time, and then understanding why Nazis would build an iconography around a symbol that was specifically used by white Europeans to exoticize themselves, is a really great way to understand what was happening and why it was able to be utilized. To quote Campion's brilliant article for the last time, quote, "The Nazi use of the swastika stems from the work of 19th century German scholars translating old Indian texts who noticed similarities between their own language and Sanskrit. They concluded that Indians and Germans must have had a shared ancestry and imagined a race of white, godlike warriors they called Aryans." Mm-hmm. So taking a symbol that means good things, like well-being, is a really great way to sneak some of the bad things you're doing under the rug mm-hmm. for as long as you can possibly manage. And I see that when I examine the history of goblins, which is the idea that I'm taking something that you already think is bad. And if you associate it with these people that I want you to think are bad, you won't hear me tell you that they're bad.
Right. Right.
So I've chosen to really highlight European goblins because that's the real big conversation. But there are goblins in pantheons all around the world. And I'm using goblins here in that same way, which is like fey, deific, mm-hmm. not a big time mm-hmm. god, but like a little tricksy nature, usually underground guy. One famous example are duendes. They appear in various forms in Spanish, Portuguese, Latin American, and Filipino lore. In Spain, there are so many different subclasses that I was immediately reminded of the way that goblins appear in Celtic Germanic mythology. And some of the duende are quite beautiful and are just like one split away from the ancient Roman path that led to elves in the in the Celtic and Germanic pantheons. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Wikipedia says a duende is a humanoid figure of folklore with variations from Iberian to Ibero-American and Latin American cultures comparable to dwarves, gnomes, or leprechauns and conceptualized as mischievous spirits inhabiting a dwelling. This is the same kind of thing where if they're in your home, they could do good mm-hmm. or they could do bad. Sometimes they live in the walls of young children and they may attempt to clip toenails and mistakenly remove whole toes. So it's a way to get your kid to kind of like stay on top of their...
Oh, because if the kid's not clean, then it's going to come in and clean them and you don't know if it's going to take your toe when it does it. Whoopsie. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's good. Mm-hmm.
It's good. It's good.
It's good.
But my story this week is actually inspired by Korean goblins.
Ooh, okay.
But I should say that's kind of what they're called. Mm-hmm. They're called dokkaebi. And their nature spirits are minor deities that are both helpful and tricksome. And rather than coming from the death of a human, the way we saw in Knockers, dokkaebi are created through the possession of an inanimate object, mm-hmm. such as items stained with human blood or more mundane household equipment like brooms or baskets. And it's sometimes noted that those household items should be discarded or mistreated. And it reminds me so much of Brownies and Domovoy. Yeah. Like, take care of your stuff.
Oh, yeah.
So, Tracy, here's some art of a dokkaebi for you to look at.
I can't tell what medium this is, if it's like...
The way I tried to reverse engineer knowing that information, I think it's carved and then painted. It looks like it's on a chest to me.
It does. It either looks like it's on a chest or it potentially could be a piece of fabric that's embroidered. But I think you're right. I think it's a panel on some kind of chest. So we've got a green... border. It looks like it's wooden painted with beautiful little corner. Like it looks like the cover of a book almost, where you have the hinges on one side, all the corners have the little corner caps. And then in the center is a creature that has two flowers coming out of its mouth, one on each side. It's a red creature with horns and little, the ears remind me of cows, like the little like cow ears.
Yeah, I love the little cow ears.
And then flat teeth, you know, a wide mouth, but with flat teeth. There's no sharp teeth here. And then
there's two little fangs, but they're kind of hidden in the horns.
Oh, yeah, yeah. They're hidden kind of by the flowers.
Hidden in the flowers. Yeah. Sorry.
Okay, the flowers curve like horns. There's two flowers. So on each side, a flower curves upwards and then another flower curves downwards. So I'm curious if you know of any what any of these symbols mean.
I do not know why there are flowers Amazing. In that little guy's okay. mouth. I couldn't figure it yeah. out. There, but it's not uncommon to see them really kind of decorated, yeah. if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So their appearance changes, as folkloric figures are wont to do, throughout different periods of Korean history. Mm-hmm. Most popular, they've got horns, big bulging eyes, a large mouth, with notably described as sharp teeth, although in all the art that I saw, it was some sharp and some
yeah.
flat teeth. Okay. They have hairy bodies, clawed hands, and they most frequently appear at night or when it is dark and damp or in, quote, spooky environments.
Oh, I love that.
So, Tracy, it was raining where mm-hmm. you are. It's now raining where I am. It's perfect Dokkaebi weather, and I'm so sorry if I'm saying that name wrong. They also are known to dance and sing, which I feel like is a very goblin uh-huh. thing. And sometimes they just turn into hot women
nice.
To trick men.
Nice.
Classic.
Yeah, we love it.
I wish we had a running tally of how many mythological figures are one thing and then just become hot women to make men's lives hard.
It's so many.
Maybe it's just enough.
Maybe it's just enough.
Isabella Carrasco for Cultura Colectiva wrote, quote, the Dokkaebi's superpowers allow them to do many things, including making fortunes for humans, throwing a party full of food, creating fancy clothes, and filling a pond with water for a night. This is so goblin.
It's so goblin, and they're party people. I love them.
Just the mythology of little guys mm-hmm. that will either make your life so good or will absolutely ruin you is, I think, one of my favorite corners of the mythological world, which is why it breaks my heart so much that goblins are used to mistreat real people.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Again, it's that thing of stop using really, really cool characters and archetypes to then turn around and ruin the lives of real people, because you're ruining the lives of real people and you're ruining the character archetype in that order, but both are happening.
Right. Both are happening and real people are always more important. But wouldn't it be nice if real people just weren't being
yeah,
harmed?
Yeah, you could just not do that part. That'd be great.
So my story this week is based on the only really detailed story that I found specifically about Korean goblins.
Ooh, I'm excited.
And a quick content warning. Humans in this draw their own blood. It is a literal pinprick, but I just want to flag it. Once there was a very poor village that rested high in the cold mountains. The people who lived there worked hard for the little they had and spent many nights praying they had just a little bit more. A bit more money to fill their purses, a bit more straw to fill their beds, a bit more food to fill their bellies. But night after night, week after week, month after month, year after year, no one answered their prayers. There was one home that sat above all others. Not because it was especially well-appointed and in a position to look down upon the people of the village, but because the occupants of this home were so exceedingly poor that they could not afford to live on the clear flat land of the village and were forced to build a small hut among the rocks. The husband and wife who lived here had no time to pray, as they spent their hours trying to coax a small garden from the meager soil between the stones, hunt the scrappy game that scurried at this chilling height, and caring for the children who continued to be born between the couple year after year. Each night they collapsed into their bed so tired from the day's labor that they did not pray. They only cried themselves to sleep and hoped that tomorrow would bring fewer tears. One night, a goblin popped his head from a nearby cave and pointed his big eyes at the home high on the mountainside. This small creature was the nearest neighbor of the poor family and looked none too pleased that this was the case. The wife and children that lived inside were crying, as they often did, from hunger and fear that they would never eat again. Their wails were amplified by the resonant cliffs and drowned out the sounds of even the mountain's wind and the village's prayer. The goblin did not like this at all. So the little creature sighed and twitched his wide ears, which were quite full of the irritating sounds, and began trudging down the mountain on his wide, flat feet that were perfect for scrambling among the rocks. He moved silently up to the hut, as goblins do most things silently, until he came to rap upon the door. "Human, your lamenting is worse than the shrieks of 100 ravens and the thunder of 1,000 cannons. I cannot sleep and beg you to end your screaming." On the goblin's final knock, the man opened his door, broom in hand, and shouted with great fear, "Begone, beast!" The goblin was prepared for this and leapt back from the swipe of the man's stick. He knew foolish humans were apt to judge that which was unfamiliar. The goblin perched on a rock at a safe distance, leaning his small head toward the would-be farmer. "I would like, very much, to be gone, beast. But your children are crying, and your wife is wailing, and I cannot sleep." The man blinked at the goblin for a long time, having believed until this moment that such creatures were not real. He looked like a small but wrinkled child covered in gray-green fur and with exceedingly large ears. His wide eyes were glaring and flashed in the night like a cat's. His words had an ever so slight lisp, owing, it seemed, to his protruding canines. The goblin seemed to grin at the man too widely as he spoke, despite the anger in his tone. The goblin waited for a moment while the human man stared, before judging him to be too stupid to speak to such a powerful being as a goblin. So the mountain creature pronounced each word slowly, his wide mouth forming around the sounds as if they were brand new. "What will make you leave this place so I might have peace?" He waited. "Human, what do you hate above all things so that I might scare you off my mountain?" Perhaps direct questions would get equally direct answers, and the loud fool would provide the directions to his undoing. The man seemed to lose his terror then. "I should ask you, goblin, what do you hate so that I might scare you off my mountain?" Now the goblin really grinned. He leaned back as if rocking in a chair, long fingers tapping his chin. "Above all things, I hate human blood. It smells terrible and chills me to my bones to see it smeared rich and red upon the human items I might like to steal. So I stay away in my rocky cave and fear the power of men." The villager smiled his own sly smile, believing himself to be quite clever. "Well, I hate gold. That is why you see none of it around my home. I despise money and wealth of all kinds, so I built my hut high on the mountain where no riches can reach me." The little goblin smirked and fluttered his ears with excitement. Then, with no further discussion, scurried back up the rocks away from the man and his wailing family. The next day, the poor villager and his wife took great care to prick their fingers and leave little dashes of blood upon the small number of valuables they possessed: a basket in need of caning, the weaponized broom, a wooden spoon, and some chipped crockery. As they worked, they discussed their fear that the goblin might return in the night, enraged that the humans had foiled any attempt he might make at stealing their belongings. Meanwhile, the goblin was trudging deep into the mountains, through the winding paths beneath his cave, and singing and dancing along to a merry tune. "For my trick you fool have fell, for I like blood, I like it well. Blood makes friends, and friends make fun. So take your gold, my mountain's won." The goblin giggled to himself as he plucked bits of gold from the rich vein that ran just beneath the poor villager's home. He scratched at the walls and danced along the mountain path until he could fill his cap with the sparkling mineral. Then he prepared to return to the home of the foolish human. There were no cries filling the evening air tonight as the full moon rose and the goblin came to the surface with a sigh of relief. It was beginning to rain, so the creature was perfectly happy to perch on a rock and watch the hut until the human man came out, broom in hand. The goblin opened a long-fingered hand and blew a fine dust of gold into the man's face as soon as he came near. He cocked his head and watched as the man cried out, enraged by the blinding, then overjoyed at the sight of gold, then feigning fear of the substance. "Oh no," he cried, "not gold." "Gold indeed, foolish man." The goblin leaned forward on his hands with excitement. He was enjoying the expulsion of the humans much more than he'd anticipated. The man did not expect the little goblin to appear with actual gold, and could not keep his gaze from straying to the shimmering bits of rock that filled the little hat in the creature's hands. He began to devise a plan to encourage the goblin to return with more gold, night after night. "That is not enough to scare me. You've hardly startled me with gold so few as this. And I have blood in defense of your tricks." The villager brandished his stick again, flashing the small smear of red along the bristles of the broom. "Thank you very much, human." The voice of a goblin filled the darkness with gratitude. But it was not the familiar voice of the man's foe. He looked down with a start to see that where once he grasped the handle of his broom, he now held a goblin by the arm. It grinned and waggled its fingers at the man as he brought it up to eye level. Drawn close, the new creature bit the man on the nose and giggled as it tumbled to the ground amidst the sound of his shriek. The first goblin sighed to disguise a laugh. "Human blood upon your household tools makes goblins, silly man. You ought to listen to the stories of your peers." But he could not stop himself from finally laughing when screams of fear, so different from the previous night's sobs, echoed from the hut behind the man. From out the door came tumbling the poor wife, a gaggle of children, and four smiling goblins dancing with joy to come alive from the family's household tools. They each resembled the items of their birth. One goblin was low and round, with a woven quality to their hair. Another was thin, with a large head. One was small, with chipped teeth. And the last was quite a bit larger than the rest, with strong arms waving with joy. Seeing the goblins, the man joined his wife and scooped up one of the smaller children. Having no broom with which to posture, he simply herded the family away from the hut, shouting nonsensically about baskets and blood. There was one child from the poor family who was not particularly fast on her feet, and she looked from one goblin to the next, clearly confused why such small and furry beings were causing her family to run from their home. Humming his little tune and leaping down from his stony seat, the clever goblin that created this new company came over to the little girl. She had a dirty doll under her arm and a thumb in her mouth, which kept her from crying or speaking at all, and the goblin appreciated this very much. He held out his hat to the child and smiled the exact smile that had, only moments before, sent a chill down her father's spine. "Take this with you, human girl. We goblins have no need for gold, and it seems you need it quite a lot." The girl's eyes went wide as she reached out a chubby hand. Even at her tender age, she knew that gold meant food, and she was very hungry. The goblin reached over to one of his new friend's ears and wiped off the small dot of human blood from its creation. Holding a finger to his lips, he placed the small red bead upon the head of the girl's doll. Then he turned and scurried away with the other goblins singing, "Blood makes friends, and friends make fun, so take your gold, my mountain's won."
My first thought was, this is so fantastic, and I love the idea of they both think they're tricking the other. My next thought was, aw, the goblin's being really sweet to the little girl. And then at the end, did he just turn her doll into another goblin?
Yeah. I just like the idea that a doll is a household tool for a kid.
Yeah.
Well, okay. So the idea, well, there's a story from the Dokkaebi mythos that, like, this man was talking to the goblin every night and was starting to turn into a goblin.
Oh.
And I don't know what that was, but the story that I like is that they were mutually trying to trick mm-hmm. each other. And in that story, the man just, like, covered his house in blood. And I do not know where that came yeah. from. But I wanted to expand upon it and have the goblin know that the trick was happening mm-hmm. and also know, one, have gold mean nothing to the goblin because we're subverting the trope. And two, be perfectly willing to give it to the human
right.
just so that the human will leave him alone.
Right.
Like, you can have gold. Just go away
and shut up.
And I like the idea that the goblin is nice to the child because, again, I think subverting that, like, blood libel mm-hmm. cruelty to children, but also that this is following in the nature spirit trajectory of, like, I'm nice, but I'm still gonna mess
oh,
around.
Yeah. Yeah. This was great. I loved this.
I'm so glad. I'm so glad that you liked it. I just think goblins can be so cute.
Yeah.
I love their big ears. I love their big ears and their little old man faces. Like, they're
tiny little old men with big giant ears, and it's precious.
And I want to specify, like, not the bummer anti-Semitic drawings of goblins, the ones where they just look like babies, like regular human-faced babies that have been squished.
Yeah. I know exactly what you're talking about, and I love it.
So we're doubling back. How far does the association with goblins and anti-Semitism go? At some point, we have to ask ourselves, with any depiction in fantasy, in any genre, when is a depiction doing harm, and when are we looking for trouble?
Yes.
For example, is every evil fictional character that seeks wealth anti-Semitic? What if they have a beard? What if they have a hooked nose? Like, when, at what point does it mm-hmm. become anti-Semitism? When are details suggestion? When are they specificity? When are they happenstance? I think we're seeing this all over the place. Like, we have very purposefully anti-Semitic depictions. We have people thinking goblins just look like this and not having to be in a position to consider what anti-Semitism means mm-hmm. if they perpetuate that. And I ask this as a rhetorical because I do not have an answer. I think very often the answer lies in the middle. And in explaining the history, I want to make clear that it's not as easy as we might want to, like, reclaim goblins. And knowing that they aren't always or originally anti-Semitic doesn't mean that they aren't used that way today.
Right.
And it doesn't mean that we don't need to reckon with that legacy when we create new fiction. And my very, very brilliant friend kind of was talking this out with me, and she pointed out that, like, you can't clever or think or intellectualize your way around racism.
Mm-hmm.
Like, knowing things and trying to puzzle your way through it just will never stop it from existing. And hopefully we will get to a point one day where Jewish people are treated kindly and fairly and goblins have not been used cruelly for long enough that there can be stories with goblins that don't look like caricatures of Jewish people that can be fun little nature spirits. But we're not there yet.
Right.
Even though I love goblins dearly, and I think that there's so much there that is interesting and fun and engaging, even looking at Korean goblins, quote unquote, dokkaebi, even representing them, exploring that mythology where they are tricksy and sometimes do ill, even when we're halfway across the world from Cornish Tommyknockers, mm-hmm. we still have to reckon with the fact that goblin lore always engages with anti-Semitism now in 2024.
It's interesting to me that the dokkaebi got put under this goblin umbrella when it sounds like in their own mythos and language, that is not the word used for them.
Well, I mean, yeah, the goblin umbrella is wide and casts quite a big shadow, right?
Yeah.
Like, are dwarves really goblins? Are gnomes really goblins? Are pukas or kobolds? Like, it's a tangled web.
It is. I mean, when does it turn into fae? Because I always thought of red caps as fae creatures, but there are also goblin creatures. So it is it's a tangled web. It's exactly what you said. And it's just like you said, too, there is no way to intellectualize yourself out of that problem.
But I'm glad we had the opportunity to cover the episode. Thank you for indulging me, because it's something that I devote a lot of time and energy to thinking about. And I, while it would be nice if it would be as simple as a tweet wants it to be.
Right.
It's just not.
Yeah.
From a folklore perspective. At the end of the day, none of this complication outweighs the do no harm element, the take we try to have with with mythology.
Yeah.
But, you know, we're here for the learning part. And I think that falls under the category of the learning part.
I agree with that, for sure.
We did it. That topic was stressful.
You did an amazing job. I need everyone to know that Rowan spearheaded all of that research and really tackled this episode, and you couldn't have done a better job. That was amazing.
Thank you. I always know that I'm like intensely invested in a topic when I stop reading my notes and just look at you and lose my place.
Yeah, I've been there too, where you get into a flow and you get into this like excited thing where you're talking and you remember this one thing that you read but didn't include in the script, but now it's got relevance and you want to bring it up and talk about it.
I'm sorry that I kind of ranted at you.
I love that you ranted at me. Are you kidding me? Amazing.
Do you want to tell me something good? Wait, I'll say it right. Tracy, will you tell me something good?
My something good is that tomorrow a bunch of friends and I are getting together for another craft night, which is just always so fun. It's not intentionally a ladies-only group, but it's just sort of turned into a ladies-only group. And and what we're doing tomorrow is our friend Marianne has a lot of like little beads. And you can melt them into pixel art type thing. You know, Marianne works with kids, so she's got all these craft things everywhere.
Oh, I know what you're talking about. Mm-hmm.
So we're going to be doing that. And I'm really excited because it's going to be one of the last times I get to see my friend Lisa before she has her baby, which I'm also very excited about.
Oh, yeah. That's adorable.
I know.
And also such a casual, fun way to hang out.
It is. This group is great because it's so low key. It's chill. If you want to do the craft, awesome. If you don't, just hang out. I'm really looking forward to it. It's just a good group of good people. So that's my something good.
I want to come.
You're always welcome. Just quick hop on a plane. It's totally worth the cost. It's a good investment.
Okay, pixel art, here I come.
All right, so now it's your turn, Rowan, to tell me something good.
All right, I'm totally cheating. I got a 5-star review. I'm going to read it to you, Trace. It's about us.
Aw, I love 5-star reviews about us.
Okay, so this is from Dude Goldblum, which is the funniest username I've ever heard.
Very good.
Tracy and Rowan bring such a warm and inviting way for the listener to be a part of the fantasy that they are speaking about. Being a former child that was obsessed with mythology and fantasy, the weight of the world hasn't allowed me to pursue this more into adulthood. However, this shows me that it is possible to scratch that itch no matter the age. I feel like I'm with my charismatic friends who are telling me a lovely story when I listen.
Aww.
Isn't that good?
We're the charismatic friends.
That's so nice. Thank you.
It's so nice. I'm so glad that we could bring the love of mythology back to someone.
Welcome. Welcome back. Or maybe, you know, none of us ever really leave.
No. Once you have that dragon book as a kid, it never leaves your soul.
The dragonology book. My whole collection is back with me. My parents very kindly sent it across the country for me, my dragonology collection. I'm complete. My right arm is complete again.
Incredible.
All right. So we have a little announcement. This is our last standard episode before we go on an indefinite hiatus. Tracy and I were offered some really exciting opportunities, including continue to collaborate on some stuff, but they are time-consuming projects.
Yes. So we know this is probably a bit of a surprise and definitely not your favorite news to hear on this podcast, but if you've been with us for a while, we just wanted to say thank you and give you a heads up. And we wanted to invite you to send over any thoughts or questions you have, because this will be your last chance for a little bit to ask us questions. And in the next episode, we're going to be discussing mythology, storytelling, and maybe answering some questions if there's anything that you want to get in.
Yeah, talking about what we've learned across all these episodes.
Yeah.
Storytelling in general.
Man, we've learned a lot.
Yeah, we gotta talk about mythology after all this time. If you are on our Discord, please know we have no plans to shut it down. If you are one of our wonderful patrons who've chosen to join us there, please continue to utilize the space. We'll still be around. We love having you. It's kind of the best.
It's the best. So we still plan to pop into the Discord, and we want you to have access to that amazing community. So continue, please, to enjoy it.
And if you've always wanted to join the Discord, you know, become a patron now, I guess. Yeah. This could be your moment.
So we wish we had more information about what the future of this show will look like, but unfortunately, we don't. So as soon as we know anything, you'll know. Rowan and I built this podcast to have the chance to collaborate and write together. And it has done just that. It's given us the opportunity to do that and so much more than we dreamed. So we want to thank you all so much for coming on this journey with us, and know that it's not over.
A huge shout out to everyone who's listened, all of our patrons who show up every week to keep our mics on, folks who have sent us wonderful, kind, thoughtful notes, either in snail mail or in our socials. We would not have the ability to do the fun secret projects that we're working on without you. And if you all weren't here, it would just be Tracy and I talking alone.
Which we do a lot, so it's nice to have a break.
Yeah.
So with that announcement out of the way, I just wanted to say thank you so much for joining us. And remember that stories grow with the telling. So if you like what we do, tell a friend.
Or tell a foe. And we'll see you soon, okay? Thank you so much for joining us for the Willing and Fable podcast. This episode was written and produced by Tracy Harrison and Rowan Hall. That's me. Our logo is by Jamie Harrison, and our music is by Taylor Ash. If you ever want to watch or read what we're reading, head over to willingandfable.com for our show notes and custom merch, or find us at Willing and Fable on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok to join the discussion. We hope you'll rate, review, and subscribe to our podcast using your favorite listening source. And check out Willing and Fable on Patreon, where we have more than a few surprises for you, including custom artwork, stories, and access to our secret Discord channel. And of course, join us next time for another round of original retellings and in-depth research on the history, mystery, and mythology that makes the world so fascinating. Run, fly, be free!